so I'm trying to fix the communal issue right now.
Okay, so now that we have brought Sam's food out of the way, we'd like you to think a bit about the projects and we want to meet in groups and think about what it is you want to do. And remember that you have, you know, X minutes, maybe about 20 minutes to present some aspect of that project. By no means does it have to be, and probably by no means should it be, inclusive of that topic. So we mean the topics are very broad. So you want to think about the kinds of things that interest you, maybe you can argue it out a little bit and narrow it down. And then you don't have to have everything totally nailed down, of course, but we'd like you to have thought about it some and then anoint a contact person who can set up a meeting time for us so we can sit down and talk about it. Okay? Any questions about that? All right. So we're well into inductance now.
And last time we started thinking of inductance as a circuit element or as a process that can happen in a circuit. And you can think of inductance sort of in two different ways. And one is where you where you're stuck at home and basically you talk to yourself. And so the idea is that if you have some sort of circuit, a loop, for example, and you're changing the current in that loop, it will change the magnetic flux going through itself, which will induce an EMF in itself, which has a proportionality to the rate of change of the current, because that's going to be proportional to the rate of change of the magnetic flux. And we call that constant of proportionality the inductance, or in particular, for the, in this case, the self-inductance of the system. And we give the symbol L, and it's in units of Henry's. Instead, you know, you could have a date, and you go out and talk to somebody else. And so if I change the current here, it will change the field going through this loop, and it will induce an EMF in the other loop. If the current in the second loop changes, it will change the field going through loop one, and it can induce an EMF in loop one. So in both cases, the magnetic flux is going to be proportional to the current in the other loop. And it turns out that if you go from 1 to 2 or from 2 to 1, the constant of proportionality is the same because the basic geometrical relationship between the loops hasn't changed depending on which way you go. We call this constant of proportionality the constant of mutual inductance because you're talking to somebody else instead of yourself. And you have basically the same relationship, but now you use this different constant. Unless you really ask specifically to think of it in terms of a mutual inductance problem, very often L is what's used for common things. And you sort of think about it in terms of self-inductance, whatever's happening in the circuit. So that's sort of the usual way you think about it. In reality, very often in a real circuit, the life is made difficult because of the mutual inductance of one part of the circuit on another, or something else over here to the circuit that you're playing with. So if you ever do anything with high-precision electronic signals, you'll find that this is an enormous thorn in your side, and you have to do a lot of work to try to minimize it. So in general, after all of this, most of the time, the way you want to think about it is that you have an induced EMF that is proportional to the rate of change of the current, and you have a constant proportionality for a given circuit. So that's what you'll deal with most of the time. That said, you will run into problems where you want the, it will be couched more in terms of the mutual inductance. Any questions on that?
Is there a way of finding the constant of mutual inductance of the experiment? Is there a way?
Yeah, if the geometry is tractable, and you can calculate the field and stuff like that. Yeah, you can calculate it exactly. And you will. And so for things like an infinite solenoid inside of an infinite solenoid, or a current loop, in an area where you can understand the field, then you can calculate mutual inductance. So you'll certainly do that.
Yeah. And so, like, if you change the current in loop one, will you get both self-inductance and mutual inductance? And normally we just concentrate on loop one and loop one.
Sort of depends on what the question is that's asked as to, but yeah, if the current changes in loop one, you will have a self-inductance of loop one talking to itself and a mutual inductance of it talking to loop two.
Okay. So we used an example of a solenoid in talking about the energy stored in a solenoid or an inductor as you increase the current from zero to some value I. And from that we actually extracted last time that the B field, so in the
capacitor, the way to think about the energy flow is as you put charge on the capacitor, it creates an electric field between the plates, and that's where the energy is stored. And in an inductor, it's similar, except as the current increases, you're building a magnetic field inside the inductor. So think of it as a solenoid initially has zero field, and now you increase the current going through there up to some value. And as you do that, you're creating this magnetic field in the solenoid. And so you think that's where the energy is stored. So if you interpret it as such, what we found when we looked at the capacitor in a specific geometry, we were able to extract an energy density in the electric field because we knew the size of the thing and we knew how much energy was put into it to charge it up. And we found that the energy density in the electric field goes basically as the square of the electric field magnitude. And when we used the solenoid geometry and we did sort of the same thing and asked how much energy is in, does it take to establish this magnetic field in the solenoid, and then divide it by the volume, we found that we have an energy density in the magnetic field that goes as the square of the B field magnitudes. So in the end, these don't say anything about the specific geometries that we used. So these are actually general statements about the energy in electric and magnetic fields. We also, along the way, we calculated the energy in an inductor as 1/2 Li squared, which is sort of easy to remember because you're probably used to 1/2 CV squared for capacitors now, and it's very similar. Okay. So then toward the end of class last time, we looked at our first circuit with an inductor in it. And we call it an LR circuit because it has an inductor and a resistor. So here's the basic circuit. And so we have an EMF, an inductor, which is always drawn as this little springy-like thing, and a resistor. So there's your L and your R. And so the first thing that you might want to do with this circuit, if it's just sitting here, is to actually flip the switch so that the inductor and the resistor are connected in series. And then ask what happens. So what we found was if you do Kirchhoff's law around this, you get the EMF minus LdI dt. So you have a voltage drop across the inductor that depends on the rate of change of the current. So this is the induced EMF in the inductor. And the minus sign basically is telling you it's fighting what the EMF is trying to do to it. It basically fights the establishment of the current. That's sort of what the inductor is doing. Have you ever been in a house where occasionally the lights would just dim? And if you paid attention, you could correlate it to something like the compressor turning on the refrigerator. That's sort of what's happening. So the compressor is a motor, which is made up of a lot of coils of wire and magnets and things. And when it turns on, you're trying to establish a current in this thing, and it fights very hard via its inductance what's going on. So you basically have this induced EMF that if the house is old or the wiring isn't just right, it will actually drop the voltage in other parts of the house and cause lights to dim. So, I mean, it's something you actually do run into. You sort of see the same thing in cars when you start them up and the lights will dim a little bit. Anyway, so we have EMF, and then we have this term across the inductor, minus LDIDT, and then we have a term of voltage drop across the resistor, which is the same old IR that you've seen before. So now we have just a differential equation, which we can solve, and the solution to this, and you can plug it in and solve it yourself and see that it works, for the current, goes as EMF over R times this 1 minus E to the minus T over R L. This form is the form that you saw for capacitors in an RC circuit where we were solving for the charge on the capacitor. And what we found was that as you started charging up the RC circuit, the charge would build exponentially, basically, on the capacitor, but it would asymptotically rise to the value of Q is equal to CV. In this case, you have a similar thing, except the equation is in the current. The behavior, mathematically, looks the same. So we have the current that rises from zero, because when the time is zero, this term is one. As the time increases, this term drops from 1, so you're subtracting effectively smaller and smaller amounts from 1, so that this quantity grows like so, asymptotically reaching the value of this E over R. So the current will start out rising quickly, but starting at 0, and then asymptotically going to the value epsilon over R. And this will happen with a characteristic time scale of this T sub L, which is given, as you call this, the inductive time constant, because basically it characterizes how fast this rises. In the time L over R, well, when this T is L over R, then this becomes E to the minus 1, so you always have this characteristic rise of 1 over E. So if this time constant is big, it rises slow. If it's small, it rises very fast. So if we now have this thing with the B field fully established in the inductor, the current now has reached its sort of asymptotic value. We now switch the other way, so that we effectively have this circuit, which is now just in the LR circuit. In the capacitive case, we sort of call it discharging RC here. We don't have charge flowing, but we basically have a magnetic field established in this L, and we initially have the large current flowing through, and now you try to switch it off. And again, when you try to switch it off, the inductor always fights the change that is happening in the system, right? So basically the inductor means that in the system keeps the current from dropping to zero immediately. Another way to think about it is that you've got this B field in the inductor that basically now has to disappear because the current's trying to go to zero. And so the energy that's in that B field more or less keeps the current going for a period that depends on this R over L time constant. So you start out with the maximal current because that's what you have when you flip the switch off, and then it will drop exponentially. Kirchhoff's law is simpler. You don't have the EMF in here, so you get this equation, and you can probably solve that one in your heads right now. And so you solve for the current, you get an exponential drop in the current. Starting at t equals 0, you have this value E over R. So it drops like so. Again, large T means it drops slowly. Small T, small tau means it's dropping fast. Okay? Yeah.
What happens if you switch like halfway and the inductor still wants to get rid of it, still wants to keep the current at the current value? So where's the current value? Where's it just dropping?
Halfway.
Like you flip the switch so it's not connected to either end after the inductor is pulled.
You have the field there, and you're trying to change it, but I don't know what really happens. The current has no place to go. I'll have to ponder that one a little bit. I'm not really sure what happens there.
Alright, that one's gonna bother me. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm
pedagogical shortcoming. I'm supposed to say, what? You don't know that? You tell me next class, okay?
Alright.
So let us suppose that I have a situation which should look very familiar to you now, and that I have an LR circuit, and I have a switch, and the switch is open, so nothing's going on initially. I have a light bulb basically hooked across the inductor, and a light bulb hooked across the resistor. Okay? And now, I throw the switch on. What happens? What do you think?
Both the light bulbs are initially very bright and then they dim out a little bit.
Okay. Both light bulbs bright and then dim out.
Well, actually, can I change that?
Yeah.
I'd say that light bulb 2 is just immediately at its regular brightness, and then light bulb 1 is initially bright and then dims out.
Okay, so the second round says that light bulb 2 is at some sort of normal brightness. Light bulb 1 is very bright and it dims out. Why would you think that? Go ahead and defend it.
Well, I was just thinking that the inductor will fight current initially, but you'd eventually get some current. And so you would have less current going through the light bulb.
Anybody want to take him on? What do you think?
I think at first it'll start off both light bulbs dim, and they'll slowly increase to a certain brightness. But the relative brightnesses of bulbs depends on the inductance and resistance.
Okay. Let's see what happens. What I have is a light bulb which is across the resistor here, and a light bulb which is across an inductor here. It's a mongo inductor, that's a huge coil. Okay, so big inductor, big resistor. They are plugged directly into it. It's a DC source, but it's a big source, okay? So inductor, so this would be light bulb 1, and that would be light bulb 2. Okay? You ready? Drum roll, please.
That wasn't supposed to happen.
I don't know, it probably was. I wasn't supposed to leave it down. Okay, so bulb across the inductor bright, then the resistor bright, and then when I let it down, that one goes immediately and that one drops slowly. So bulb across the inductor is bright first, and this is dim to nothing, okay, and then it slowly brightens. And then when I shut it off, this one goes off immediately. Or no, it gets off. What does it do? So this one dims out. So this one gets really bright initially when I blow it off. And then the resistive one falls off slowly. So I don't think it fit any of the models we said a moment ago. So what's going on?
The one that's across the inductor is just bypassing the inductance completely, right? Which is why that just turns on the
Well, this is a big resistor and a big resistor. So you can sort of imagine that this is bright when the voltage between those two points is high. Right? And the same is true here. When is the voltage high across of an inductor? The induced EMF across an inductor goes as LdIdt. So this will be bright when the rate of the current change is large. This will be bright because it goes as IR, it will be bright when the current is big. So I throw it initially, and initially what's happening? I have a charging LR. I mean, we can think of it in different ways. Initially you have zero current, and then you throw it, so you're going to have a big rate of change of current, going from zero to something. So you should have a big voltage drop across the inductor. But the current hasn't grown very much yet because the inductor is slowing it down because you're establishing the B field. So the current through the resistor should be nothing at that point. So that means the voltage across here should be nothing. It should be big here. That's why across the inductor it's very bright initially. You have nothing here. And then as time goes, the current grows, but the slope, the rate of change of the current drops, so this dims down some, okay? But now the current is growing, so this will, the voltage here is growing, and you'll slowly brighten up, okay? So mathematically, this is the current, right, in the circuit. Starts at zero, so you have no current, no voltage across the resistor, but you have the biggest slope. So you'll have a very bright, your voltage drop across the inductor will be biggest. That's when you'll have the most current through that light bulb. And then as time increases, the rate of change drops, but the current increases, so you're going to have the inductive light will dim down, but the resistive light right now to a steady state. Okay? And then when I cut it off quickly, which is exactly your question, okay? You note the behavior was different, but it got extraordinarily bright for a moment. So I think what happens there is that in this case, this became the resistor. So we had a closed circuit across the inductor and the resistive bulb. So we threw all of the energy into that bulb very, very quickly. Okay. If you don't have that pathway, I still am not exactly sure what happened. So.
All right. Any questions about that? You good with that? All right, so physics works sometimes. Okay. What's next? Oh man, don't tell me. Okay. I can probably pull some of it out my butt, but I think we will all benefit if I actually take a moment and walk over to my office and grab my notes. Because I didn't bring them. So, with my apologies, I'll be back in a minute. Frequency.
Sorry.
Huh? Yeah. Well, yeah, so I need to keep a track of it and make a plot. Alright, so sorry about that. Anyway, so things get more interesting if we add a capacitor into the system. So right now, let me take the resistor out of the system for the moment. So let's just look at an LC circuit. So there's our inductor. Actually, that's a bit too sick of an inductor. Let's try a little bit. We can make a better inductor than that. Then we have a capacitor. And I don't have an EMF in this system, so we're going to assume that we have a fully charged capacitor. And we basically then connect it right across the inductor. And so we're going to say that the resistance is zero in this particular circuit, which is, without superconductors, is a bit of an approximation, but let's not worry about it. So at any given point, the energy in this system, the total energy, is going to be the energy that is stored in the electric field in the capacitor. As that discharges, you have a changing I, right? So you'll be developing a B field in the inductor. So the total energy of the system is going to be U sub E plus U sub B. So at any given moment, that will be the charge across the capacitor plus the energy in the inductor. Okay. And for fun, let's look at the change in the energy with respect to time. So this would be the power in this particular circuit, which will be the rate of change of the energy in the capacitor plus the rate of change of the energy in the inductor. So the charge is flowing in the capacitor, so we have to take the derivative with respect to time. So this is 2q times dq over dt divided by 2c. And this is times L times 2i di over dt over 2. And remember that this is dq over dt, which is also that. And because we have no resistor in this particular problem, the power output is zero. Okay, there's no place for it to go because you don't have a resistor in an ideal case. So that means we can basically drop the dq dt's here and here, and we end up with 0 is equal to L di over dt plus q over c. Okay? And remember that I is equal to dq over dt. Is 0 times is equal to L yes, this should be Q. Can you tell me about that equation? At this point, you all should look at that equation and go, holy crap,
Sub-harmonic motion. Right? You've got the second derivative term. And you've got a linear term in Q. If you pull it over the other side, it's like a spring equation, right? So you should be able to look at that and you go, okay, that's simple harmonic motion, and you have a frequency of whatever, which is square root of 1 over LC. What's the whatever? What's oscillating? It's the amount of charge on the capacitor. So what you have is the charge on the capacitor is just oscillating in some harmonic way. Okay? Which is going to clearly make the current oscillate in a simple harmonic way, which is going to make what's happening in the inductor happen in a simple harmonic way. So you have this circuit where basically the energy flows, the charge is built up on the capacitor, and when it is, you have all the energy stored in the electric field. And at that point, the current is zero, because you just sort of built it up. And now the charge starts to flow off, and when it does, you have a current that's building up, and so the energy in the inductor starts to grow, and you get a magnetic field. The energy in the electric field is dropping because you've reduced the charge, and so you now are building the current and the field over here. The charge goes to zero, and then it flips. So you have the charge basically just doing this from one side of the capacitor to the other. And when it's in the midst of flowing, you get a big B field, but you have zero E field. And then after it flows, you have a big E field and zero B field. And so this is basically it's a ringing circuit, and you just have this oscillating energy going back and forth. And it's cool. It's okay to think that's cool. It's actually very cool. It's even cooler when we sort of look at it more carefully. So this is something we know all about. So what we have when we look at this is we have simple harmonic motion in charge as a function of time with omega squared is equal to 1 over LC. So that means that omega is giving you the frequency of this oscillation of the energy back and forth, or the charge back and forth, if you want to think about it. So we can, recognizing that this is a harmonic solution, or harmonic equation, we can actually write down the solution for Q of t, which is equal to the total charge you have in the system times the cosine of omega t plus phi. All right, so omega here, omega squared, we already know, is this 1 over LC. If we take the derivative of this, the current as a function of time, it's minus omega Q times the sine of omega t plus phi. And phi basically just gives you the initial conditions. So. And you could start out with the sine here instead of a cosine, so hopefully you're very familiar with that kind of stuff and waves. Okay? So if we look at the energy, now that we have charge and the current as a function of time, let's look at the energy flow. So the energy in the electric field is going to depend on how much charge is on the capacitor, which is going to be, the energy goes as Q squared over 2C, and Q, we figured out, goes as this cosine omega t plus phi. So this becomes
big Q squared over 2C, so that's the maximal charge that you can have on the plates, times cosine of squared omega t plus 5. So this would be the energy stored in the capacitor. Or the E field, depending on how you look at it. And if we look at the energy stored in the magnetic field, that goes as 1/2 times L times I squared. I we've calculated already. And this would be the energy stored in the inductor or the B field. Omega squared is equal to 1 over LC, so this whole quantity becomes squared over C if you want. So I mentioned that the energy sort of flows from one to the other. If you time average a square of the harmonic function, you get a half. So these basically time average to a half, but notice that they're out of phase in terms of actual time. One of them goes as cosine squared, one goes as sine squared. So what that means is you'll have maximal energy in the E field when this is zero, and vice versa. So if I just plot those equations out as a function of time, you get this. And this happens with a characteristic frequency or period that goes as 2 pi times the square of L times C. So you have this ringing in the circuit. It actually has a period. It's cool. I like to picture it this way, because this is what's actually happening. As a function of time, let's say we start here. We start with all the positive charge here, creating an electric field maximal like that. Then as the charge begins to flow, you begin to build up a B field here. This is, E field is reduced. Then you have maximal B field, zero electric field, and then the whole thing reverses to the point where now you have the positive charge up here. And etc. And this whole thing just rings back and forth. And this is what's known as LC oscillation. Since all circuits basically have inductance and capacitance, in principle, they basically all do this kind of thing. But they also have resistance, so we're about to have a resistor in, and that complicates things.
So is this just analogous to when you have the spring that transfers energy from the spring potential to the kinetic and passes its equilibrium condition and it transfers them back and forth?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you can say that. You okay with this? Yeah.
Why does the electric field of capacitance fall off?
The charge flows. So you have the charge built up on the capacitor, and it will begin to flow
And as it does, the current grows, so the magnetic field grows. But because you now have less charge on the capacitor as a function of time, the field will drop in strength. And basically, it'll keep going, but because you have this inductor, it sort of keeps going until all the charge is the other way, and then does that. It's neat. So one of the things that I want you to notice in this is that the circuit has a natural frequency. In mechanics, did you do forced oscillations in 141? Okay, so if you did that, what you found was mechanical things will have a natural frequency of vibration, sort of where you get the normal modes. And if you excite the system in the normal modes, it can be destructive, right? You get really big oscillations. So electric circuits also have natural frequencies of oscillation, these electric and magnetic fields. So what you'll find is you can get some very interesting effects due to that. So in order to get at that and to look at LRC circuits, basically, what I want to do is to make a shift from DC circuits to AC circuits. And very often, for a little bit pedagogical, because I actually think it's good to see things from different points of view, but also just because I have my favorite places to go and it's not always your textbook, most of my notes and things, what I use in lecture, I just use other sources, and I try to pick a textbook which is reasonable, which covers the same stuff, and maybe it's complementary. For AC circuits, it turns out my favorite place to go is Ohanian, so it's straight out of your textbook. So my apologies for that. I'm not too bad. I had a mechanics professor at Columbia who shall remain nameless. It was like the equivalent of Doug Klein's mechanics class, I guess. And he would walk in and literally copy the equations from Simon's mechanics onto the board. And he would talk about them a little bit, but basically you could just pick up the book and you knew exactly what he was going to write. It was well discussed in the book. I thought, wow, this is a complete waste of time. He didn't add anything to the class. So it makes me feel guilty when I sort of do this, so sorry about that. Bohemian, I think, does a good job, but anyway. So for AC circuits, the way to think about it is you don't have a fixed voltage battery. You have a battery that has an EMF that varies sinusoidal. Okay? So it's all one way, and then it goes to zero, and then the sine of EMF flips to have a maximum value on the other side and back. So that's when you have that kind of device in the circuit, you call it an alternating current circuit. And you can imagine why it might make sense to do this, because if you take a loop of wire in a strong magnet and you hook this wire to a rod and you have like a waterfall here spinning the loop, then if you were to calculate the induced EMF in that wire, it'll vary sinusoidal. So mechanically, it's a really easy way to build a generator, basically. So that's where you end up getting stuck with AC circuits. Alright, so for an AC EMF, usually you see a little different symbol, so something that maybe does this. A little squiggly means it's sinusoidally varying. And let me first just put it across a resistor.
and let's ask what happens. So when we have this harmonically varying EMF, all we mean is that it has some maximal value and it varies as sine omega t. Omega is the frequency of the generator for what comes out of the wall plugs here at 60 hertz, but it's something that's actually variable because some country can choose a different value. It may be AC, but at any given moment, potential still means what potential did. You still have Kirchhoff's laws, and so you still can sum the voltages going around. When you come back to the same point, you better get zero. So that means that the current at any given time is the EMF divided by R. So that's going to be 1 over R, I'm sorry, that's going to be the EMF max times the sine of omega t. So if I am sinusoidally varying the EMF, it's going to sinusoidally vary the voltage across the resistor, so I get a sinusoidally varying resistance. And they are in phase, right? Because the voltage across the resistor is exactly the same as that across the EMF. So the power at any given instant goes as I times V across the resistor, which is basically I times this EMF. So that goes as E max squared times the sine square of omega t divided by R. So if I calculate the power, it will have a maximal value, which is this E max squared over R. Like a sine squared curve. So this first zero will happen pi over omega, and this one will happen at 2 pi over omega, etc. But if I'm actually going to boil water or heat a room, I don't actually care about the time dependence of this thing so much. But I do care about the time average. So I want to know what is the average power this thing puts out over time. And so if I time average a sine square curve, it becomes just 1/2. So that means the average power that is put out by this resistor in the AC circuit, which I'll put a P with a bar over it, which people often use to signify a time average, goes as the maximum voltage squared over 2 times R. So sort of half what you would have expected in a DC case. Okay? if we look at the EMF, right, this one goes as E max times omega t. This current is in phase, and it goes as this E over R. So we can actually plot them on the same curve. Depending on which one I look at, I'll do different colors. So the EMF goes as a sine. And this value is E max. But the current stays in phase. And it has a value which is E max over R. Okay. So all of that is a discussion about a resistor that's sitting in this AC circuit. So now I want to do the same thing, but I want to look at a capacitor. So what I'd like to do now is to have a varying EMF across a capacitor, and we know at any given time the charge on the capacitance is equal to the capacitance times the EMF, which goes as C times E max times the sine of omega t. And the current is the derivative of this. So we get cosine of omega 2. So now notice, for the resistor, as we've seen, the current in the resistor is in phase with the EMF. The current on the capacitor is going to be out of phase, which is a little bit weird. Plot the current, it goes as a cosine. Which is not drawn perfectly, sorry. And it goes to a maximal value, which is this C omega E max.
So, in a nice attempt to have job security, electrical engineers and such will say that the current in the capacitor,
I'm sorry, the current in the resistor lags the current in the capacitor by a quarter of a period, or a quarter of a cycle. Because right, if you look at you have maximal current in the resistor, you had a quarter cycle previously had maximal current in the capacitor. Or another way to say it is that the current in the capacitor or another way to say it is that the current leads. So I talk about the resistor and the capacitor, but in fact we've only analyzed circuits where they're not in the same circuit, right? So that's more complicated when they're in the same circuit. So in the case of the resistor, the current and the EMF are in phase. In the case of the capacitor, we say that the current leads the EMF by a quarter cycle. So it starts to look a little more complicated than what you get. So another thing that's sort of interesting here is that you can almost think of this capacitor in terms of it being a resistor. If you think about the fact that you have you sort of have a dependence on the current and the EMF here that's very similar to what you see with the resistor. So if we try to remember that for DC circuits, V is equal to I times R, then I is equal to sort of this EMF divided by R, which is so the EMF across the capacitor goes as this Emax times cosine omega t, and that's equal to this I divided by C omega. So if you think of this as the EMF across the capacitor, and if you were to think of it a little bit as a resistor, that V is equal to IR, that works if you have the resistance look as this 1 over CW, of C omega. So the way to say it is that this quantity, let me rewrite it. And actually, it's usually written omega C, so I'm going to do that because you get used to saying it. So this strange quantity, this 1 over omega C, mathematically sort of plays a role of the resistance across the capacitance in an AC circuit. And so in the interest of job security, what we do is we call this quantity we define it as the capacitive reactance. And we can't call it 1 over omega C, we call it a big chi C. So you can think of this as a resistance in a capacitive AC circuit. You okay with that?
This omega is just a characteristic of the marginals.
This omega is the frequency of the EMF. So this means that the degree to which you have this resistance will depend on what frequency the drive is.
as well as the capacitance. Which may make some sense because the capacitance is a measure of how much charge you can put on the thing, and the frequency is how fast are you varying the CMF. So you can imagine that your ability to shove this charge on there has some dependence on that frequency. Okay, so we have looked at a resistor in an AC circuit. We've looked at a capacitor in an AC circuit. And so now what I'd like to do is to look at an inductor in an AC circuit and see what that looks like. So the EMF across the inductor, well, if we do Kirchhoff's law, we have EMF minus L dI over dt is equal to zero. dI over dt well, the EMF goes as this E max times the sine of omega t. So that means that E max times the sine of omega t is equal to L dI over dt. We can integrate this out to find what the current is. It's minus E max over omega L times the cosine of omega T. So the current in an inductor is also out of phase, but it's flipped in sign relative to what we saw with the capacitor. So if we now look at this as a function of time, and I'll first put up the standard E and F, which is varying sinusoidally. Now, if we look at the inductive, the voltage, the current in the inductor, it goes as cosine with the sine flipped. So it looks like this. And the value that it rises to is E max over omega, that's not T, that's L. And again, if we look at this, we have sort of an EMF piece, and we have a current over here, and so this omega L will again play sort of a role as a resistance in an AC circuit. So you can rewrite this as omega L, omega L I, but this is basically sort of an EMF piece, and you say that that's equal to high R in some sort of a fuzzy sense, in which case this omega L is playing the role of a resistance in terms of relating the potential to the current. And we define this as the chi sub L, and we call it the inductive reactance. So for AC circuits, we have, it's not so simple. We don't just deal with resistors. We sort of have to deal with this reactance, which is sort of the resistant way that capacitors and inductors will act with circuits. I'm going to let that hang until next time because I don't have time to pull it all together and give you the punchline today. So we're just going to review this and then come back. And I promise you that it will be something sort of cool Tuesday, but I don't have time to do it today.
So are you saying you said it's going to be good with the punchline?
Depends on your sensitivity.
Mine's a little twisted.